This is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Taylor Quimby, in this week for Sam Evans Brown. You only have to count to three on the periodic table of the elements before you get to lithium. Hydrogen, helium, lithium. It's the lightest metal in the world, light enough to float, soft enough to cut with a butter knife, a silvery white that's almost luminous until it's exposed to air. With a single electron in its outer shell, an atom of lithium is also highly unstable. It wants to react to just about everything around it. So you won't find pure lithium in nature. It's always in disguise, dissolved in a saltwater solution or locked up in a crystal.
There's no lithium nuggets. There's no mines where you just go underground and hack out chunks of lithium ready to go. That's not how it works.
This is Emily Hirsch, the self-styled first lady of lithium. She's a consultant who's worked in oil and gas and even gold.
That idea of pure lithium as a chunk of metal only exists in specific laboratory conditions.
Pure lithium metal has to be kept in certain conditions so it doesn't react to air or water.
Because it'll burn or it'll catch on fire.
Which didn't stop me from ordering some off of Amazon.com just to see it for myself.
Look at this.
Yes, you can buy pure lithium on Amazon. It came in a tiny glass vial filled with mineral oil. I poured it into a metal pot full of cold water with my son. The lithium sizzled like garlic in oil, bubbled and steamed until there was nothing left to see. You can find more dramatic reactions on YouTube.
Oh! Wow! Holy crap!
Despite its tendency to combust, lithium has had a lot of uses over the years. To make specialized ceramics or glass, medication for bipolar disorder, and lubricants as a trigger for thermonuclear bombs. It was even an ingredient in the early formula for 7-Up.
7-Up, so pure, so good, so wholesome.
But all those applications will be dwarfed in the coming years by its use in lithium-ion batteries for electric cars.
You try to pick the element that is most changing the way that we as human beings interact with energy. It's lithium, because lithium gives us the ability to pick energy up, carry it around, and use it later.
Batteries are arguably the linchpin that binds our transition to renewable energy together. We need them to store the power from wind and solar, and we need them on the road. After all, cars and trucks account for a full 20% of all U.S. emissions. Moving away from gas vehicles is essential. And lithium-ion batteries get better and better every year. One hopeful Tesla competitor, a company called Lucid Air, says its first electric vehicle will get 500 miles on a single charge. That's far enough to get from New Hampshire, where I am right now, to Washington, D.C., with 10 miles to spare. So it's no wonder that after years of relatively slow growth, people are paying attention. Electric vehicles only account for about 2.8% of global car sales today, but the more optimistic reports suggest they'll outpace gas vehicles in 10 to 20 years. That means loads more batteries and loads more lithium. A few years ago, Tesla and Panasonic built what was then the biggest lithium-ion battery plant in the world, the Gigafactory in Nevada. Here's CEO Elon Musk.
It's actually going to be, it's not just going to be the biggest lithium-ion battery factory in the world, but it'll actually be bigger than the sum of all lithium-ion factories in the world.
Today, Tesla is building a new plant, this time in Austin, Texas, the Terra Factory. When it's finished, Musk projects the factory will use as much as 800,000 tons of lithium annually. That's 2.5 times current production for the entire globe.
So it's difficult to quite describe in words, but it's a heck of a big factory.
So where's all that lithium going to come from? This is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. In one version of a sustainable carbon-neutral future, the world's cars will transition from fossil fuels to electricity. And right now, the vision of that world absolutely depends on the lithium-ion battery. But when you try to square that world with the reality of the global lithium supply and what it takes to extract it, the vision is not so simple. One problem, or let's say challenge, with transitioning to renewable technology is that the future may require way less fossil fuels, but it will require a monumental increase in these specific types of metals.
Graphite, lithium, cobalt, rare earths, scandium, copper, silver, platinum, palladium. The mineral intensity of those compared to now, in some cases, is 800 times what it is today.
Solar panels, wind turbines, batteries, they all rely on stuff that comes from mines.
I think there's a cognitive dissonance in people in general that mining is a thing of the past, or that mining is bad, or that things don't come from mines. They came from a mine.
Laptops, tablets, smartphones, digital cameras, e-bikes, hoverboards, all these things contain lithium. But lithium isn't a raw commodity like steel or coffee beans or natural gas. It can't be traded or passed around by and for different products. It's only useful when processed for particular uses, and for batteries, for particular battery chemistries. Compared to combustion engines, batteries might actually seem simple from an engineering perspective. But from the perspective of the supply chain, the steps required to buy, transport, manufacture, and assemble a product, lithium-ion batteries are arguably much more complex. To learn more, here's Emily Hirsch again and Chloe Holzinger, a battery analyst with IHS Markit.
So the lithium battery supply chain has at least five specific stages. You've got your mineral extraction.
Getting the lithium out of the ground.
That's your mine. Much more on this stage later. Step two.
You've got your lithium chemical production.
The third step is really taking that lithium chemical and making a cathode powder.
Batteries have two sides, a cathode, an anode, and in between, an electrolyte.
Then you've got the battery cell makers.
Cells are maybe what you think of when you picture a battery, like a double or triple A.
And then from there, it's those cells are shipped to, you know, a final step.
The battery pack makers.
For the longest time, I thought Tesla batteries were bigger versions of the one in my Honda Civic, one big square block. Instead, they're made up of more than 7,000 cylindrical cells, lined up and wired together in a thick casing that monitors and directs the work of the individual cells. This is the battery pack. It's a complex machine in its own right, and it's designed to be virtually indestructible. Remember the exploding Samsung phones from a few years back? That's what happens when your lithium-ion battery pack fails. But in the case of an electric car, well, it looks like a flaming car.
Oh, shit, dude. It's a brand new car. Wow, I can feel the heat in here. Oh, that's a Tesla, dude.
For the most part, each of these steps belongs to a connected but separate industry. Industry separated by expertise and equipment, and often by geography.
Today's lithium-ion battery industry is, you know, pretty heavily segmented by region.
The breakdown you're about to hear is a broad simplification, but generally speaking, it is true.
Lithium comes from South America and Australia. Cobalt comes from the Congo. Nickel comes from Indonesia. The batteries get made in East Asia.
There are a lot of minerals we could have focused on for this episode. Cobalt, for example, which is mined in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where issues around child labor have been raised by both critics and advocates for electric cars. Because of these issues, some, but not all, battery makers have effectively lowered or eliminated cobalt from their batteries. The reason we're sticking with lithium is that experts have told me that virtually everything in the lithium-ion battery can be substituted, except for lithium. In other words, whatever pressures the lithium supply chain is subject to now have to be addressed. But there is no central lithium planning committee that is balancing supply and demand or strategizing on how to extract it in ways that prioritize the environment or social justice. There's just the market and a patchwork of regulations that differ from place to place. So, despite being so interconnected, links in the lithium supply chain are sometimes dangerously siloed. Chloe has been to industry conferences up and down the world of lithium. At electric car conferences, she says, you'll see
demand charts just like exponentially increasing.
Upstream at the battery conferences,
it's like a bunch of nerds geeking out about like, this is a cool battery chemistry.
But all the way at the source, in the raw materials department.
And then you go to a lithium conference and it's a little more conservative. It's really a stretch to make that connection between the battery in your car and the mine where it comes out of. And I would say in my experience, the only people who have regularly asked me questions about that tend to be oil and gas companies.
Oil and gas. Upstream from the Green Revolution is an industry that's still built on the principles of extraction. An industry that hasn't moved as fast as the renewable tech on the other end. A surplus of raw lithium materials in recent years has made prices fall. That, in turn, slowed production. After all, why increase the supply if prices are low? But with demand expected to increase dramatically in the near future, there are fears that it will soon outstrip supply. Some analysts are projecting shortages of battery-grade lithium as early as 2022. So what does it mean to mine lithium? We'll find out after a break. Welcome back to Outside In. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Sam Evans-Brown, and today we've been talking about the soul of the lithium-ion battery, lithium. Hard rock lithium mining, like mining coal or gold, is a very messy business. Traditionally, it's meant open pit mines, layers of carved out earth so big they sometimes look like inverse mountains. These types of mines, even for a quote-unquote green mineral like lithium, require staggering amounts of energy. They produce loads of carbon dioxide, waste includes heavy metals and acid drainage that can contaminate earth and water. And from the 1950s until the 1980s, nearly all of the world's lithium was extracted from a pair of mines just like that in North Carolina. All that was before 1991, when Sony released the first consumer product to use a lithium-ion battery, the Handycam camcorder. Since then, global lithium production has increased dramatically. But as demand has grown, and the products that lithium enables proliferated across the United States, lithium mining in America became virtually non-existent. So if we're not mining our own lithium, where is it coming from? And who is being affected?
It's hard for perhaps listeners to understand just how remote of a location this is. This is 200 plus miles northwest of Las Vegas and 200 plus miles south of Reno. The nearest town is Dyer, which has maybe 100 people.
This is Patrick Donnelly, the Nevada State Director of the Center for Biological Diversity, an environmental organization that in the pantheon of environmental organizations stands out for prioritizing endangered species over land development, even if that development is for renewable energy. The place he's talking about is called Rhyolite Ridge, a long dry slope that lies on the western side of an ancient volcanic caldera. It's home to a little red and yellow flower called Team's buckwheat.
It is about 6 inches tall when it's at full bloom, so that's a couple weeks a year. The rest of the year, it could be just a couple inches tall of its foliage, or during the winter, it's just a stump. So to be honest, except when the flowers are at full bloom, it's not much to look at.
The soil in Rhyolite Ridge has such high mineral content that most plants struggle to take root there. But there is one plant that thrives. Rhyolite Ridge is the only place in the world where you'll find Team's buckwheat.
There's 6 populations of the buckwheat, which are spread over a couple square miles. The mine's footprint, the open pit footprint, would encompass 85% approximately of the buckwheat's habitat.
Rising above the vast high desert between Reno and Las Vegas, Nevada, the 100% Ioneer-owned Rhyolite...
Team's buckwheat grows on top of a mix of lithium and boron ore, a deposit that a company called Ioneer is hoping will be the first to bring U.S. lithium mining back up to speed.
...is expected to become a globally significant, long-life, cost-effective source of critical lithium and boric acid, vital to a sustainable future. As the first major American supplier...
The mining of lithium and other metals is governed in the United States, to this day, by the General Mining Law of 1872. It states that American citizens over the age of 18 can prospect for certain minerals on public land and stake a claim of mineral rights for just $2.50 to $5 an acre. There have been lots of efforts to update these laws, which have remained relatively unchanged since the gold rush. Most of these efforts have died in Congress. No wonder Patrick feels like the game is rigged.
Nevada is a banana republic for the mining industry. The mining industry runs this state, the mining industry owns our politicians, and the mining industry does whatever the hell it wants in Nevada.
That being said, staking a claim does not a mine make. Ioneer has been working to develop a mining project since 2007, 13 years and millions of dollars later in research and development, and they're still a couple years away from actually producing lithium at Rhyolite Ridge. With that kind of investment, it's no surprise to hear they are doing everything they can to push forward.
So this is basically Ioneer's solution to the buckwheat problem. Their solution is, well, we can wipe it out in its native habitat and we'll just stick it somewhere else and call it good.
When Ioneer discovered that their mine project would cover most of the flower's habitat, they started funding studies at the University of Nevada to see if scientists could artificially cultivate and replant the buckwheat to another location. Early results are looking good, but through a right-to-know request, the Center for Biological Diversity in Nevada also obtained documents that reveal how Ioneer has pressured the scientists to release findings before that work is completed.
Ioneer is trying to use this science to greenwash the mine when the science itself is inconclusive, and I think the thing that was most revealed by these records were that the researchers are deeply uncomfortable with being put in that position.
Patrick says that Ioneer is trying to use this early science to present an optimistic future and prevent Team's buckwheat from being listed under the Endangered Species Act, which, of course, is exactly what the Center for Biological Diversity is petitioning for.
We recently got a positive initial finding from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So that moves the buckwheat to a longer formal 12-month review period for that endangered species status. So we will be waiting for that.
If the flower gets listed, it could spell the end of the mine project at Rhyolite Ridge. Assuming, that is, the flower survives long enough to be listed at all. Since we first put this story out on the podcast just a couple of weeks ago, the Center for Biological Diversity has reported that 40%, nearly half of the entire buckwheat's population, has been removed from Rhyolite Ridge and presumably destroyed. There are pictures that look like rows of empty gopher holes where the plants used to stand. Scientists are divided as to whether the damage was caused by rodents, which is possible, or humans. Patrick is quite sure it's the latter. Another tectonic shift in lithium news came this week at Tesla's Battery Day announcement, where CEO Elon Musk and his VP of Powertrain and Engineering told a crowd of reporters the company was going to reduce their costs by getting into the lithium extraction business themselves.
So lithium is not like oil. There's a massive amount of it pretty much everywhere.
They'd secured rights to 10,000 acres of land in where else, and said that from a physics standpoint, they pioneered a new method of extracting lithium from lithium clay.
Simply mix clay with salt, put it in water, salt comes out with the lithium, done.
I mean, it's pretty crazy.
Yeah. So we're really excited about this, and there really is enough lithium in Nevada alone to electrify the entire U.S. fleet.
I don't expect it's going to be quite that simple. And experts from inside and outside the industry are very, very skeptical of Tesla's claims. Before all this happened, the destruction of the flower, and Tesla's announcement, I asked Patrick Donnelly, what did he think about the tension between the need for lithium and the costs of mining it?
Well, look, we are in a global extinction crisis. Biodiversity is what gives us clean drinking water and clean air to breathe and puts food on our table. And so if we let species go extinct because of our own desires, you know, we are threatening our own way of life on Earth. And so I hear you. We need lithium. There are many, many, many places to get lithium that don't have an endemic species of wildflower directly above them.
If this were a coal project, there would be little conflict for environmentalists. It would have all the same harms and none of the benefits. But mining for materials related to our renewable transition forces environmental activists and policymakers to confront trade-offs that traditionally were problems blamed on the opposition. Whatever raw materials aren't produced in places like Rhyolite Ridge are produced somewhere else, places where mining may put other species and other human lives at risk. Climate policies like the Paris Accords and the Green New Deal have pushed for a dramatic increase in renewable technology, but don't tackle the tough decision-making those increases will require. This isn't a problem that the environmental movement is ignoring, per se, but conservatives, sometimes in bad faith, have leapt on this reality, claiming that the cure for climate change is worse than the problem. And they're not just talking about for the environment, they're also talking about U.S. security. Rare earth metals, like lithium, require a complicated chemical process in order to become useful from a commercial point of view. Here's Emily Hirsch.
China blew everybody out of the supply chain by providing capital to and, in essence, subsidizing that second step. The U.S. realized that we are dependent on China for this chemical that's needed to make permanent magnets, which we need to make electric vehicle motors, that's needed to make regular vehicle motors, that's needed to make windmills, that's needed to make missile guidance systems. But even that realization has not been enough to change the behavior.
National security hawks have seized on this fact to point out that because some mineral supply chains have grown largely outside the United States, dramatic growth in renewables puts money in the hands of the Chinese. That doesn't have to be the case for lithium, Emily argues, but it will be if we aren't willing to make trade-offs.
The critical minerals for the battery supply chain, they are in the United States. So why don't we extract them and process them in the United States? Because it's more expensive. Why is it more expensive? The United States has some of the highest environmental standards in the world. It's a reality.
After a break, we head south, where a lot of lithium mining is already underway. Stick around. Welcome back to Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Sam Evans Brown.
When we talk about governments or economies that are dependent on natural resources, we mean the kind of most upstream part of a supply chain.
This is Thea Riofrancos, author of Resource Radicals, about South American conflicts over oil and mining, and an upcoming book called Brine to Batteries. She likes alliteration.
Yeah, I know. Apparently it's a thing for me.
Thea says that the trajectory of South American resource extraction starts 500 years ago with the Spanish conquistadors mining for precious metals.
When the Spanish first came, we were looking at a lot of gold and silver.
And continued into the modern era with agribusiness and petroleum products.
Oil, soy, beef, rubber, right, from the Amazon before synthetic rubber was invented.
Sugar,
tobacco, bananas, tropical fruits.
And that trajectory continues today in the form of lithium brines. People who know about the subject will have been wondering when I was going to mention that 60% of the world's lithium reserves, which is to say 60% of all the economically mineable lithium we currently know about, can be found underneath the massive salares, or salt flats, of South America.
You know, you are 7,500 feet in the air, but like around you, there's mountains that go way taller than that, right? Some of them are snow-capped, some of them are volcanoes.
Salt flats are ancient desert lakes, closed basins, where shifting climate and geology led massive quantities of water to dry up, leaving behind a rich crust of minerals and salt. They're landscapes that sometimes get compared to the moon or to Mars.
So the whole expanse is like white and gray, these little patches of like red, and all of these shades in between white and gray that you don't even know exist until you kind of see them. So it's just like a very odd, like...
The salt flats of Argentina, Chile, and Bolivia are also David Attenborough famous.
The vast salt flats of Chile's Atacama Desert were seemingly designed to repel life. Which animals are capable of conquering these lands? The flamingo, of course. More commonly recognized as pool inflatables or garden decorations. The neon pink birds.
What you won't see in nature documentaries, though, is that the edges of the salt flats are also home to dozens of indigenous communities. And what you also won't see is that in some cases, just miles away from nature reserves and flamingos, are the lithium brine plants.
The lithium is in this brine that's on that subsurface, and it is sucked out. You know, we can just think of it like a drinking straw or something. It is sucked out, and it is then arrayed in these enormous, like many football field size, evaporation ponds.
They are in some cases literally bigger than nearby indigenous towns and objectively mesmerizing to look at. There are bright blue ponds next to greenish ones and brown ones, all of them perfect squares or other unnatural shapes. Do a Google image search for lithium brine ponds, you'll see what I mean. But how do they work? Well, these salt flats are some of the driest places on Earth. They're hot. There's almost no rainfall. So they pump the brines into ponds. Sunshine evaporates water. Mineral content increases. Once it's high enough, they pump it to another pond and the process keeps going. The brines get thicker and slushier as they move from pond to pond. And eventually, the lithium content is so high, they can move it to the next step for chemical processing.
They don't have to use a ton of like toxic chemicals or reagents to like help the concentration process. Mostly it's nature doing the work.
But by pumping out all of this underground brine from underneath these desert ecosystems and then letting it just evaporate into the air, lithium brine plants pose a different problem. They deplete groundwater.
If you talk to anyone from any of those companies or watch a webinar with them or see them quoted, they will always say that brine and water are two separate things. And like brine has like no human value. So whatever, right? No one else agrees with them. And I mean, no one else, like regulators in the Chilean government, even those that are in favor of lithium development, don't think that there's no relationship between brine and freshwater.
Activists, scientists, and community members have all warned the amount of water and brine being extracted from mining threatens to destabilize fragile ecosystems and economies. When mining companies deplete brines, Thea says, the freshwater that sits on top and around the brine is dragged down by gravity and other natural forces.
Regardless of whether the freshwater is directly being depleted, which it is, but regardless of that, and regardless of whether it's being directly contaminated, which it is, it's also literally being made less easy to access through the irrigation systems for farming and potable water.
Opposition to mining here isn't universal. There are communities, indigenous communities even, where people have welcomed the opportunities that lithium companies promise. But others aren't buying it. And in some areas of the Atacama Desert, you might hear or see a familiar phrase. Water is life. No to lithium.
Extraction is normalized in the global south for everyone, for us and for you.
This is Ramon Morales Balcazar, founding member of the Plurinational Observatory of the Andean Salt Flats. When I spoke to him, he was in Mexico City, where he goes to school, in a room with tall concrete walls, a towering skylight, lots of hanging plants. It was beautiful, but it sounded a little bit like a pool, FYI.
Between 20 and 25% of lithium in the world comes from Atacama Salt Flat, so that's cannot be sustainable.
For about 4 years, the Plurinational Observatory has been fighting expansion of lithium mining and raising awareness about the water issues, that it threatens livelihoods and ecosystems.
So a lot of people thought that it would be impossible to stand against lithium mining because it's like a green mineral.
One thing that has made the group pretty successful, relatively speaking, is that they draw on a coalition from the entire area, sometimes reductively referred to as the Lithium Triangle.
A bunch of indigenous leaders, academics, some activists from this three countries, and also from different nations, like Atacama or Licanantay Nation, Coya Nation.
Still, it's an uphill battle, Ramon says. If you think the mining law of 1872 is lax, remember that the regulatory structures in most Latin American countries are far more mining friendly than what you'll see in the U.S.
Because the brine is cheaper. That's why they like brine so much. It's just cheaper, and our regulations are super loose. Companies like SQM, actually, they are involved in corruption, bribery. They've been interfering, actually, in the environmental regulation itself.
SQM is a Chilean company, by the way, one of the biggest lithium producers in the world. The principal stockholder is the son-in-law of former Chilean dictator Pinochet. I asked Ramon what he thought about the situation in Nevada, where the Center for Biological Diversity is fighting the Ioneer lithium mine on account of the team's buckwheat.
Yeah, maybe that's another aspect of this coloniality behind extraction. So in Atacama Salt Flat, actually, there are many species, there are many plants. There is a lot, actually, to save there, to preserve. But for some reason, nature in our side of the planet, it's totally disposable. And for some reason, a tiny plant in Nevada is not, which is good, you know? But it makes you think how people see, you know, themselves, nature, their duties, actually, towards nature, their nature, because it's theirs.
When you talk about the social and environmental costs of a renewable energy transition, the narrative inevitably starts to feel like a zero-sum game. Our electric vehicles for the extinction of a flower, or the water source for a people and a desert ecosystem. Every person I spoke with for this story rejects that notion.
There's more research going into looking at the brines that occur alongside oil fields, or the brines that are found in geothermal deposits.
There are promising technologies out there that allow for lithium to be extracted using an electrolysis process, and then water to be reinjected.
Car companies are getting concerned about this. And I don't want to say they have good motives. Their motives are their brand, right? But Volkswagen sent a team of observers to the Atacama Desert to look into the supply chain issues, because they're like, you know, maybe our consumers...
There are promising new mining technologies that could reduce water waste, lithium recycling startups that could reduce our overall production needs, compacts that give communities more agency around mining projects that take place in their backyard. But most people I spoke with also acknowledged, with visible discomfort on Zoom, I might add, that the trade-offs aren't as utopian as we'd prefer.
You know, I guess the point here is that, like, just because we are transitioning to a future that's powered by clean energy doesn't mean that we are going to relieve ourselves of the fundamental dynamics underlying extractive industries.
This is Julian Brave Noisecat, Vice President of Policy and Strategy for the left-wing think tank Data for Progress. He says a lot of environmental justice advocates were driven to action because of oil, gas, and mineral projects that exploit Native communities, poor communities, and communities of color. So, understandably, the push for renewables is part of a desire to emancipate society from that paradigm. But action on climate change is needed urgently.
And, you know, this is something that I wish was not true, but I guess the reality of politics and policy is encountering truths that you wish were not there, but are in fact there, which is that there may, in some instances, be a trade-off between essentially just and equitable outcomes and the imperative to move very quickly. I think that that's largely a function of the fact that we've waited so long.
For activists, that trade-off may be even harder to swallow as time goes on. When I was speaking with battery analyst Chloe Holzinger, she said something that at the time I didn't quite understand.
Now is actually a really good time to make an acquisition in various different parts of the lithium ion battery value chain, you know, while vehicle sales are, potentially going to fall due to a recession. Impacts of an economic recession.
It took me a minute to realize what she meant, which was that now is a great time for legacy fossil fuel companies, the ones that activists want to hold accountable for their actions in the past, like ExxonMobil or Shell, to get into the lithium game.
I personally don't think that we can make this huge energy transition to, you know, clean technologies without bringing along some of those older players.
Here's a weird truth to contend with. The first lithium-ion battery was patented by Nobel Prize winner Stan Whittingham in 1979 when he was working for ExxonMobil.
ExxonMobil played a key role in inventing lithium-ion batteries, which they then had a mixed role after inventing them. But, you know, they were there at the very beginning.
Yeah.
So
partial credit.
Right. Exactly.
Of course, all of these trade-offs are built on the assumption that there is one we aren't willing to make, which is a world that isn't filled with electric vehicles. At least, not as many as you may have imagined. Here again is Thea Riofrancos.
Consensus in the US seems to be, we're all gonna own Teslas or whatever, maybe not Teslas, those are kind of expensive, but we're all gonna own electric vehicles. We're gonna swap in our ICE vehicles for electric vehicles. We're gonna change nothing else. We don't need to change the highways. We don't need to change the fact that we have this privatized transit system. We don't need to change the suburbs, the built environment. What I think pains me the most is the idea that we're going to change nothing about the way that we consume or produce and just switch out like the energy source, and a lot of the environmental effects are going to remain.
So which future is it? The one where our lithium comes at the cost of traditional environmental and social concerns? The one where we change our behavior, even just a little, own one car instead of two? Or a future we haven't yet dreamed up?
It's very troubling because we don't have another paradigm in which to deploy. You know, we don't have some alternate mining industry that isn't a bunch of shady operators and environmental villains to tap into.
In order to clean up our energy, someone, somewhere, is going to get their hands dirty. The question is who?
So, you know, I don't know, maybe I should quit my job and go into lithium extraction. Maybe that's the future, is all the environmentalists become energy developers and mining executives.
Handful of quick updates here. Since this story first aired in September of last year, the price of lithium has seen the first sustained rise in 3 years, in China anyway. The price of Tesla's stock has soared, making Elon Musk the richest man in the world. In the final days of Donald Trump's presidency, his administration rushed to clear the way for new and existing oil and gas leases on public land throughout the country. And among the many decisions made during that period was an approval of a Nevada lithium mine, just miles from the one we discussed in this story. The Center for Biological Diversity in Nevada is now appealing directly to the new Biden administration to list Team's buckwheat under the Endangered Species Act. It's not clear how they'll respond, but anecdotally, the Biden campaign did say last October it was in favor of boosting domestic mining for metals needed to transition to renewable energy. And that, of course, includes lithium. If you're just joining us, this is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. And today we've spent most of the program talking about the lithium supply chain. But lithium isn't the only resource required to transition America's 270-odd million cars from gas to electric. There's graphite and manganese, sometimes cobalt and nickel, and also less tangible resources, like active buy-in from our primary car brokers, dealerships, and salespeople. In late 2019, the Sierra Club released a report called Rev Up, a nationwide study of the electric vehicle shopping experience. And what they discovered was that experience is not always so great. 579 volunteers visiting nearly 1,000 dealerships across the country found that in many cases, dealerships fail to offer or actively steer customers away from electric cars. Hugh Lay was the project manager and one of the primary authors behind that report, and Hugh is on the line with me now. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Taylor, for having me on.
It's my pleasure. So I'm going to have you run through some of your key findings from that report, if you could. But I'll start with the big one, which is that about 3/4 of dealerships surveyed just straight up don't have any electric cars on the lot at all.
Yeah. That was one of the key findings of the report. And quite frankly, it was shocking to find out that almost 3/4 of dealerships across the country did not offer a single EV. As you know, transportation is currently the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States, with the primary source of those emissions coming from light duty and medium heavy duty vehicles, primarily internal combustion engines. And so it's very, very, very important at this critical moment in time to combat the climate crisis that we transform the transportation sector to be all electric. But currently, we're nowhere near there.
Yeah. And of those 75%, I mean, are some of those dealerships that actually, you know, sell electric cars, you know, for example, like a Nissan dealership that should have a Nissan Leaf available, but just didn't have any in the lot?
Yeah, so this is going to vary and depend by the state and by the city. Mm-hmm. One of the key findings that we found, and this kind of goes back to an earlier report that we did in 2016, when we only analyzed how dealerships were selling EVs in these states that have this, the ZEV mandates.
ZEV mandate is a zero emission vehicle?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah.
Right. So the 2019 report built upon that. But what we noticed, interestingly enough, is that there was much more EV availability in the states that have the ZEV mandates versus the rest of the country that didn't. And you saw across the board in our report that states that didn't have strong EV incentives, the automakers were not providing the sufficient inventory to supply the dealers, and the dealers, as a result, didn't have any EVs to sell.
Right. So talk about some of the other key findings, and especially the ones that are really sort of behavior-based on the part of individual actors who, you know, the sort of person that when you walk into a showroom, walks up and tries to sell you a car.
Yeah, absolutely. So it seemed that there was a failure in sort of the expertise and the training of the salespeople to be able to provide consumers with the proper knowledge as it relates to range, charging, and also what incentives exist. That's really important as well. There are many both federal and state incentives that exist out there that if the consumer doesn't know about it, the upfront cost and the sticker price of an EV may deter them. But if they know about the incentives, those incentives will drive the cost of the cars below that of an equivalent gas vehicle. And so what we found in our report was that the salespeople, they failed to provide this information firsthand to the consumer. In fact, in some cases, they redirected consumers towards the gas models on their lots.
Some of the quotes that were reported by your volunteers, you know, some of them sound like poor planning, where you've got someone who wants to test drive an EV, but there's only one on the lot and it hasn't been used in so long, it needs to be charged. Some of them sound just like terrible customer service too, you know, where people are really not giving information or giving misinformation.
Folks would show up, consumers would show up, and they're interested in buying an EV. And, you know, they want to test drive a car, right? But if you show up and the car isn't even charged for a test drive, you're not going to be able to make a proper decision. And in fact, it may just deter you from that dealership altogether because the dealers and the salespeople just were not adequately prepared to handle consumer preferences. We've had other situations where folks would show up and they couldn't find EVs on the lot, even though they were there, but they were buried in the far back of the lot because dealerships wanted to advertise and to promote their gas vehicles and to center those both in the showcase rooms and at the front of the lots and to keep the EVs way, way, way far in the back.
Now, say you're a car company, you've spent gobs of money developing an electric vehicle. Why wouldn't you be pushing dealerships to sell them? I mean, do you have any idea why a dealership might disincentivize people from selling an electric car over a gas vehicle?
Yeah, we're trying to find more research into this topic, but I think we're all very, very well aware that the revenue model of the dealerships rely very heavily on service and maintenance, right? And electric vehicles have proven over the lifetime ownership of a vehicle to be significantly cheaper because you're not spending money on gas, and also the maintenance costs are extremely lower. So a consumer is saving thousands of dollars annually just on fuel and maintenance costs alone. And by not being able to require the service and maintenance that you typically would need with a gas vehicle, the dealerships are losing a significant chunk of their revenue. And I think that they realize that. I think, you know, the country also has to be doing a better job to ensure that we provide the proper infrastructure to be able to support the increasing demand. And I think the automakers also are failing to meet consumer demands for EVs as well.
The report suggests a pretty sizable list of recommendations for automakers, dealerships, and people doing policy to try and address some of these issues your volunteers experienced. I think some of them are pretty obvious, like there should be more models of electric cars, so there's, you know, more to choose from. You know, actually bothering to display them in a showroom or having them, you know, closer to the front of the lot so you can actually drive one. But what are some of the less obvious things that you think could be done to help make the shopping experience better and also thereby to speed up the transition to electric cars?
You know, I think in a lot of ways we have to look at this from the top down, right? And to look at this from a structural standpoint, because the automakers have spent decades greenwashing their claims of sustainability, and it shows. You have folks like General Motors that recently announced big investments in electric vehicles and a willingness to work with the Biden administration to get our nation to 100% electric vehicles. But they have a track record of hypocrisy that we won't forget as consumers and as advocates. For example, GM, Toyota, and Fiat Chrysler and others, they sided with the Trump administration against strong clean car standards and supported the rollbacks of California's authority. And recent analysis shows that autos are spending a tiny fraction of their advertising dollars to promote electric vehicles, while the bulk of their money goes towards boosting sales of gas-powered models. And this kind of goes back to your point. A lot of these automakers, they have EV models, but they're just not promoting or selling them. There's over 41 EV models out there, but they're not getting any attention. So what we want to see from the auto industry is that we want all automakers to invest in domestic manufacturing of EVs for people of all income levels. And we need automakers to support and lobby for strong climate policy and not lobby against strong climate policies. And we need the automakers to engage in creative marketing campaigns that will educate the public about electric vehicles, since these automakers have millions and billions of dollars in their chest to be able to push these sort of education campaigns out there to the public. I think what's interesting also is that when we look at the Biden-Harris administration, they know that it is time to act. So, you know, they'll be working with governors and mayors nationwide to deploy over 500,000 public charging outlets by 2030, and also increasing incentivization with strong clean vehicle tax credits that can help both middle and low income consumers make the switch to cleaner cars.
Hmm. I said in my introduction to this interview that buy-in from dealerships is a required resource for this energy transition, but I have to wonder whether or not it is, because it seems possible that if it sort of trickles down badly, if dealerships do a bad job because they have perverse incentives to continue selling gas vehicles, even while demand for electric continues to increase, you know, what you'll see is more and more dealerships being left out of the equation. You know, for example, Tesla sort of trying to get direct to consumer. And I think about that in conjunction with the fact that the pandemic right now is already speeding up this transition to consumers buying cars online and in some ways really radically changing the way that we've been buying vehicles for a long time.
Yeah, that's a great point, Taylor. And you're right that the dealerships are critical to the clean energy transformation we'd like to see in the transportation sector. So in terms of what the dealerships can do, well, they can work with both the manufacturers of cars to secure more on their lots. And two is that they can offer better training for their salespeople and not limit their EV models that they have available if they do.
Right on. Hugh, do you drive an electric car?
It's a good question. Although I work on EVs a lot in my job at the Sierra Club, I actually do not own a car right now, just because I live in DC, and so it doesn't make much sense for me to have a car right now. So I take public transportation.
If you don't need one, you don't need one.
But if I were to live in the suburbs or somewhere else, and I actually do need a car, I would definitely go electric. So sometime down the line.
Well, Hugh, thank you so much for speaking with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Taylor.
Hugh Lay is a campaign representative with the Sierra Club. He co-authored their 2019 report, Rev Up, a Nationwide Study of the Electric Vehicle Shopping Experience. This episode of Outside In was produced by Taylor Quimby, me, Sam Evans-Brown, and Justine Paradise. Erica Janik is our executive producer. Maureen McMurray is director of recycling on Obtainium.
Special thanks to everybody who spoke to me for this story. Vivas Kumar, Brett Birdsong, Sam Kalin, and Stan Whittingham. This may be the first time we cut a Nobel Prize winner out of the actual episode. Sorry, Stan. We are a show that relies on you, our listeners, for donations to keep us going. So please give us money, and you can do that at our website, outsideinradio.org. If you can't give us money, please borrow your friends' phones and surreptitiously subscribe them to Outside In. Music in this episode by Blue Dot Sessions. Our theme is by Breakmaster Cylinder. Outside In is a product of New Hampshire Public Radio.